The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SupChina. SupChina is the best way to stay on top of all the latest news from China in only a few minutes a day through our email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, or at the website at supchina.com. SupChina offers uncensored reporting from and about China, and you can read about everything from media policy to the Me Too movement, from the U.S.-China trade war to China's ongoing draconian repression of Uyghurs in Xinjiang. We're sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I'm in Washington, D.C. this week. Joining me from fabled Goldcorn Holler, where the air is sweet, the grass is green, and the necks of the locals are a vibrant and appealing shade of bronze, is, of course, Jeremy Goldcorn, editor-in-chief of SupChina. Jeremy, greet the good people, won't you?
Hello, Kaiser. Hello, good people. Oh, dear.
Okay, well, Let's jump in. In November, news from China really shook the world again, dominating headlines really until the dramatic arrest in Canada of Huawei's CFO, Meng Wanzhou, and that, you know, grabbed everyone's attention and shifted it away. But, you know, in late November, the big news was that a U.S.-trained Chinese scientist named He Jianqi had claimed that he had edited the genes of twin babies born in China earlier that month, altering a gene that codes for a protein used by common forms of HIV, which is, of course, the virus that causes AIDS, to access cells. And so this edit, this gene edit using CRISPR, he claims effectively immunizes the babies against most forms of HIV. This was not the first time that human genes have been edited using this technology, CRISPR-Cas9, but it was the first time, if his claims are indeed true, that the germline itself had been edited and children born with their genomes altered. A significant difference.
Reaction to the news was almost uniformly outrage. This isn't surprising coming from Western scientists, including from Rice University in Houston, where He had studied. But in China, where conversations about the ethics of technology aren't as common as in the West, it was remarkable that He's announcement was greeted with such condemnation, not only by the scientific community, but also by officialdom. Institutions and individuals associated with He Jianqi quickly moved to distance themselves from him and to disavow connection with him and knowledge of his work.
So we're delighted to be joined again by one of the best writers covering science in contemporary China, Christina Larson. Christina has written extensively on China's genetic science, along with many other topics, you know, related to science, technology. And it was a team of AP reporters who broke He Jianqi's story, claiming that the birth of these twin girls with edited genes had happened. And she's worked on quite a number of articles related to this. Christina recently left Beijing and has moved here to Washington, D.C. Now writes for AP after a stint with Bloomberg and earlier work with numerous science publications, Science, Nature, the MIT Technology Review, and Foreign Policy, of course, before that, where she was an editor. Christina, welcome to Cynica, and welcome back to the USA and our little community of repatriated Americans.
Hey, thanks, Kaiser and Jeremy.
Christina, great you could join us. Let's start with a layperson's explanation for what the CRISPR-Cas9 technology actually does. It seems like I've only really heard talk of this for the last 4 years or so, but it seems to have advanced very rapidly. What does it do?
Okay, so CRISPR is a powerful tool for changing the structure of DNA. If scientists can change the structure of DNA, they can also change its function. CRISPR refers to the specialized structures of DNA, and Cas9 is an enzyme that can cut strands of DNA in specific places. For shorthand, we often call this technology gene editing, but that's a little bit misleading in that it's much easier to cut away or delete part of DNA than it is to write new scripts. Mm. So CRISPR was first developed about 6 years ago in 2012, so that means it might actually be younger than the Cynica podcast.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't throw somebody, you know, I know editors who are much better at cutting and deleting than at actually, like, giving you better words. So
sure,
it's not
sure.
That
inaccurate. Yeah, yeah, no, the reason I mentioned that, and this might be outside of what we'll talk about today, is questions like, can you create complex traits?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Could you genetically modify someone's intelligence is a much bigger question involving many more spots on the genome than can you affect a particular spot linked to a particular disease. That's right. Just what I wanted to specify. But CRISPR, you're right, Jeremy, it's moved really fast in part because it's really easy to use. You don't have to build a space station or a particle accelerator to get started. I recently saw a scientist who teaches high school who I follow on social media talking about how he was demoing CRISPR for his high school students.
Oh my God.
His aim was to actually say, we have to start really early on talking about not just how you do something, but the ethics of it.
Right.
But it's just a completely different ballpark than, let's say, you know, sending a man to Mars.
Yeah, wow. So Christina, CRISPR-Cas9 is still far from perfect, and there's still a lot of things that can go wrong. Can you explain what some of those are? You know, because I mean, I'm sure this is going to come up in the discussion about what He Jin Kuei did and the twins.
Sure. So in CRISPR, there's a ton of unknowns. And in fact, with any technology or medicine, there's a lot of unknowns. That's why scientists generally start off testing something in a lab, then in mice, then in other animals, then in humans, and then publish their work in peer-reviewed journals.
Right.
So He Jin Kuei did not publish his preclinical research on CRISPR or this particular experiment in any peer-reviewed journals, which is one of the things that really alarmed a lot of scientists and raised a bunch of questions. So to your question, there's a bunch of unknowns about what happens when you snip DNA in a particular place and the potential for immediate off-target impacts or unintended consequences. And there's also unknowns about what would happen over time, things that you might not be able to see detect immediately at a molecular level that will become evident as an animal grows. So, for example, a recent Wall Street Journal piece about gene editing in farm animals showed what that might mean. Farm animals like pigs, cows, and rabbits are already being edited for traits like not growing horns and adapting to warmer climates. But some of these animals also exhibited unintended, unusual characteristics like enlarged tongues and extra vertebrae.
Oh, man.
So those are some pretty serious genetic mistakes. And this is why a lot of scientists have condemned He Jin Kuei's actions editing human babies at this stage when so little is known as human experimentation.
So you didn't even know, I mean, when these rabbits or pigs or cows were younger animals, that they were going to have these extrovert or they were going to, you know, not grow or whatever the mutations were. These didn't express until later. So it's possible that these gene edited babies could still express like weird. Yeah. Oh, God.
Right. It's basically an experiment in the running.
By the way, I just Googled CRISPR, and first hit was a website selling reagents and enzymes for use in CRISPR. So your comment about how easy it was to use, apparently it's very easy to buy, too.
Oh, my gosh.
The question,
let's get some.
Kaiser, you better make sure Jeremy doesn't jump ship on Seneca for his new side gig.
Doing bathroom science.
Yeah, it's goldcorncrisper.com. And if you use the code Seneca, you get a 10% off your CRISPR kit. Enough of the levity. Christina, can you compare the state of CRISPR in China and the United States, the sort of cutting edge research? Can you compare them in absolute terms?
Sure. Well, CRISPR was developed about 6 years ago in the United States at MIT and UC Berkeley. And today the big research hubs are in the US, UK, and China. So there are trials underway in each of these countries to use CRISPR to modify crops and livestock. It's important, I think we should say, that CRISPR isn't only a tool for modifying human DNA, but for all DNA.
Oh, yeah, really?
And there have been a couple efforts at gene editing pet dogs in China. As for CRISPR trials on humans, on adult humans, there's a lot of research in each of these countries. For example, at the University of Pennsylvania, there are trials using CRISPR to modify immune cells to make them more adept at attacking cancers like melanoma, and similar trials underway in China, quite a number actually. But I think, Jeremy, what you're really asking is about the state of human embryo gene editing, using gene editing tools before a child is even born. And that's illegal pretty much everywhere. There's research in the UK, for example, at the Crick Institute in London, to modify human embryo cells in the lab. The goal is to learn more about the very early stages of human development.
But they wouldn't implant those.
But it's illegal to implant those in a woman's womb. And in the US, the laws are even stricter than in the UK. Government funding can't support even lab research on human embryos. Scientists in the US can do limited research, but they have to use private funding. And certainly gene-edited babies are effectively banned because you would need approval from the FDA, which it's almost certainly not going to give at this stage. Right.
So Christina, my question was a little more than that. Because of this difference, does that mean that Chinese scientists are going to be forge ahead with CRISPR technology because their research has fewer boundaries?
So in China, there's a 2003 law against human cloning. There's no law, as in something that's been passed by the National People's Congress, against human gene editing. But the Ministry of Health passed a ministerial guideline a few years ago that says that edited human embryos shouldn't be allowed to grow beyond about 14 days, actually similar to the UK. And now, in the wake of He's experiment, lots of ministries in China are saying that this guideline from the Ministry of Health is legally binding and that what He did cross a red line. So it's not the case that China is exactly a free-for-all, even if He found a way to get this done in China.
Oh, that's fascinating. Let's talk about He, the scientist who's at the very heart of this. What do we know about him, about the previous work that he's done, about, you know, why and under what circumstances he actually returned to China, you know, about his motivations for doing what he claims to have done, and maybe what some insights you might have about the guy's personality, because you've spoken to him, unlike many reporters, you've actually interviewed him.
Yep. So He was born in 1984.
Wow, he's young. My God.
He told us that his parents were farmers. I'm not 100% sure about that. But basically, he followed a common path for young scientists of his generation. He graduated from the University of Science and Technology in China. He moved to the U.S. for graduate studies. He got a PhD in biophysics at Rice University. And then he spent a year as a postdoctoral research fellow at Stanford. His Stanford advisor, Stephen Quake, spoke to the AP and described him as super bright. And then in 2012, He came back to China to take up a post at the Southern University of Science and Technology, which is a really new institution that's only opened about a year ago and is partly funded by the government of Shenzhen. So we met him on the campus of this university, which is brand new, sprawling campus, new buildings. He's in the same, his lab was in the same building as one of the fastest supercomputers in China, just to give you a mental picture of the environment that he's working in. So according to his resume, he was named part of the central government's 1,000 Talents program.
Yeah.
And He has also started a couple biotech companies with mixed success, but he's raised millions of dollars from both U.S. and Chinese investors. So he has a pretty scarce publishing record in peer-reviewed journalists as a scientist.
Peer-reviewed journals,
but he's not an unknown guy as a businessman, which is a sort of an odd thing.
As a businessman, so what's his business? What was he doing?
He has some genetic sequencing businesses.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah. Wow. So in adjacent fields. So I met him in Shenzhen in October of this year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he seemed like a clever, self-confident guy. And he actually reminded me of a lot of tech entrepreneurs I've met, both in China and the U.S. He was cheerful, energetic, and he seemed like he was really in a hurry.
Yeah, yeah.
He said he filed patents already on these CRISPR techniques in both China and the U.S., even though the results are unknown. And in the clinical trial registration documents, which is what he filed in China to state that he was doing this work, he said he thought that his work would, this is a quote, surpass the 2010 Nobel Prize, which was awarded for the development of IVF. So as a journalist, I don't want to pretend too much to be in this guy's head, but I'll let you draw your own conclusions about the kind of person who makes statements like that.
Yeah, well, there's some hubris.
Yeah, but something else I wanted to say, just that we learned during our visit in Shenzhen, that's not about the end result of the science, but the process behind it that I felt quite important.
Uh-huh.
He played fast and loose with the idea of an ethical review board, which is really a cornerstone of modern mainstream science. It's meant to prevent horrible things like the Tuskegee experiments from happening again. The Tuskegee experiments in the U.S. are when the U.S. government conducted trials on how syphilis would proceed in low-income African-Americans without informing them they were part of that. And there was a huge outcry and a debate that, you know, science has to be ethical. We have to have reviewers in place. We have to have all these questions that we ask before any kind of experiment involving humans would happen. And I think most scientists believe that ethical review boards have a really important place in modern science. But an ethical review board also is sometimes called an institutional review board in different countries. Mm-hmm. But instead of going to the ethics board at his own hospital in Shenzhen, He went around them and he got sign off from a different hospital, one that was not involved in the study. And the team of AP reporters that I was a part of, we went and we met the founder of that hospital called Harmonicor. This guy's name was Lin Zitong. And he was also the chair of the ethics board, or at least that's what he told us.
Uh-huh.
And he told us quite proudly that he wasn't a doctor or a scientist, but a hospital property developer. And he told us how many hospitals
really
his family...
To be on an
yeah, he told
board.
Us how many hospitals his family controlled that were listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. And Chinese media later reported that Lin's company had been an investor in one of his companies. So this was quite outside the expectation as a scientist journalist about what I thought would be the checks and balances about ethics.
Right. The guy's an investor in one of those companies. I mean, there's...
Yeah, and there's a bunch of other questions we can get to later, like the fact that the consent form for patients referred to this trial as an AIDS vaccine development program, which isn't quite right. The embryologist in his lab said that not all of the doctors who were participating had even been informed that this involved gene editing. So there were a lot of things about the process that we uncovered that raised questions.
Raised questions.
Yeah, you know, that's me being the journalist, right?
So, Christina, let's talk about what exactly he claims to have done, or he did do. How long has medical science known first that a certain genetic mutation confers immunity against certain forms of HIV?
Okay, so what he did. So the CCR5 receptor is a protein on the surface of white blood cells, and it's one pathway by which HIV can infiltrate these cells. And these cells play a role in the human immune system. So Hook claimed to have altered the gene that creates this protein, thereby shutting down this pathway. It's not at all an assurance of HIV resistance, but more like closing one door. And other scientists have also worked on this kind of change in the lab. So the work that Hook's trial did wasn't actually introducing a new idea or scientific method. His innovation, if you will, was finding a way to take this from the lab to the delivery room. And it's also worth noting that other research indicates that tweaking this CCR5 receptor could have other adverse effects.
So he wasn't the one who discovered that there was a certain codon that codes for the CCR5 or that switches it on or off.
No, not at all.
That was already well known. And so, yeah.
He was standing on the shoulders of giants, if you will.
Right.
So he just did what no one else would dare to do, really. Is that...
Right. So I'm curious, though... Do we know whether stopping that gene from expressing to turn that protein on, to make that protein available, does that have other effects? I mean, it must exist for some other reason except to bind, you know, to HIV, right? We don't know, right?
Well, other trials or other studies have shown that tweaking the CCR5 receptor could have adverse effects, like increasing susceptibility to West Nile virus or influenza. There likely are more than one things that happen, although we haven't seen this play out in a human being before to fully know.
So what do we actually know about how he found these subjects for the experiment? I mean, how upfront was he with these people? I mean, did he tell them what he was intending to do exactly? I mean, I guess he met the actual patients through an AIDS activist organization that was based in Beijing. And I guess he sought out an HIV positive father or would be father and an HIV negative mother. I guess I don't understand why that was necessary, why that specific combination was needed, or how he found these people or what he told them.
Okay.
What do you know about that?
he met the people who participated in this study through an HIV advocacy group in Beijing called Bai Hua. And we met the founder of this group, who seemed like a sincere activist. Mm-hmm. Basically, what they do is they create chat groups on WeChat and other things to connect people who have similar concerns. So how to come out as HIV positive to your parents, how to deal with a child who's sick, right? All these sorts of questions that people might share. So through this, they identified couples where the man was HIV positive, but the woman was not. And eventually, 7 couples participated in this trial. Mm. But to step back, I now wonder if this having the HIV positive person's parents wasn't so much about the science, but about giving a bit of ethical justification for a risky effort. Because it's important to note that this experiment wasn't about preventing the transmission of HIV in utero from parent to child. There's already a pretty standard technique in IVF called sperm washing, where the semen fluid that carries HIV is removed before the sperm is implanted. So whose proposition to the participating couples wasn't, "I will prevent your child from being born with HIV." It was, "Your child will be less likely to get HIV as he or she grows up."
Oh, interesting. So it wasn't medically necessary that this person be HIV positive. It was that he thought there would be a higher chance of them wanting to take part in this experiment because they're familiar with the dangers of HIV. Interesting.
And also, the study participants, they had access to free IVF for participating in this trial. And as you know, IVF is an expensive procedure in any country and certainly out of reach of a lot of poor families in China. Sure. So without having interviewed all of the couples who participated in this study, it's really difficult to say what motivators were strongest for them.
Sure.
Christina, let's talk about the ethics issues surrounding CRISPR, and especially about using it on humans. The abhorrence of what could easily become full-blown CRISPR-powered eugenics is obviously part of it. So perhaps you could start there.
Okay, Jeremy. Well, tell me what kind of ethical nightmare you want to talk about first.
Well, I guess
there are a lot of different ways you could take the conversation.
Well, I think we all take it back immediately to Hitler and the Nazis. We know what the Aryans would have done with this, right? You know, they would have all looked like you, right? Blondes with blue eyes, Christina.
Well, I mean, I think...
Frankenstein obviously is the original monster of our imaginations. But yeah, and then eugenics.
Not
I guess
Frankenstein.
Those two.
Frankenstein's monster, Jeremy.
I'm sorry. Oh my God, the internet's going to kill me. That? Frankenstein's monster.
I mean, I think the immediate ethical issue is, right, what's been done to these children who will grow up with unknown consequences because of their DNA being altered. I mean, I think that before people leap into this idea that, oh my God, we're going to have designer babies where everybody, you know, has a perfect SAT score, there's a big leap in the science between turning on or off a particular part of a gene and engineering complex traits. So that's right. One thing. The other thing I think that's important to say is that this experiment aside, there are a lot of mainstream scientists and bioethicists who think that CRISPR will and should have a role in the future to prevent severe inherited diseases that we have no other way to treat. For example, Huntington's disease is often mentioned as a case. So I think there's going to be a big ethical debate going forward about all these different aspects, good, bad, what's necessary, what's not necessary.
But in this particular case, the ethical problem, as far as I understand from what you've said, there are two major ones. The one is that the whole procedure did not follow accepted scientific convention in terms of submitting to ethics boards, selection of subjects, and everything else. The second major problem is that there are now 2 little girls in the world with altered genes who nobody knows what problems they may have because of what the her did to them.
Right. And, those are two.
And it was completely unnecessary.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. That's pretty bad. What he did.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll let you speculate about what our Galactica future might be. but that, you know, I'm sure we'll have future podcasts about that. But yes, I mean, certainly this experiment raises the idea that, holy cow, science moves way faster than regulation. And right. could we have something that's already real before we've even made decisions about what should be done?
So besides the bioethics issues around this, there's the question of the dodgy science involved in He's, you know, misguided project. What, strictly from the point of view of good scientific practices, did he do wrong? And besides not submitting to an ethics review board or as a scientist, he
okay, yeah. So, I mean, I think we should start with the ethics board. That's one. Not publishing peer-reviewed research of the preclinical trials is two. Mm-hmm. Apparently deceiving some of your collaborators, using euphemisms on a patient consent form. There's also
it vaccine or whatever. It was not vaccination at all, right?
Right, right. And we don't know how effective this is. But there's also evidence from the information that He presented at a human gene editing summit in Hong Kong in late November. That only half of the intended genes were edited in one of the two twins. And a lot of scientists were quick to point out, oh my goodness, how did he allow this embryo to be implanted?
When it had such mosaicism, right?
Right. And we don't know what the effects of that will be yet, but these are all questions that people have had. So one of the people that AP interviewed Eric Topol, who's the head of the Scripps Research Translational Institute in California. He told us, if you're going to do something this controversial and this early, and you want to be a leader of this movement, you need to do it in an exemplary way. And any way you slice it, I think that what we see here was not an exemplary way.
Yeah, for sure.
Christina, I was pleasantly surprised that He got so little support from the Chinese community. He was met with almost universal opprobrium within China, from the state media, social media, the scientific community, from officials as well. Did that surprise you?
Well, I guess you could say the list of Chinese ministries and groups investigating He is longer than his publication record now. So, yeah, the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, Chinese Academy of Sciences, National Commission on Health, Shenzhen City, His own university have all condemned him. But to be honest, Jeremy, when an official body makes noises and says it's launching an investigation, as a longtime journalist in China, I would say it's hard to know what that means, really. But maybe more interesting to me was the discussion on social media, which I'm sure that you guys followed really closely. A lot of normal people trashed He. They said his work was immoral, he was arrogant, he was giving other scientists a bad name. And that response felt really immediate and really visceral and unplanned, and I don't think would have been in any way directed by the Chinese government. So these two aspects of Chinese society, officialdom but also popular sentiment converging.
And other scientists, weren't there many other scientists, not officials?
Yep, there was a letter signed by over 100 Chinese scientists that condemned what He did. And I think having interviewed a lot of Chinese scientists over the years, a lot of these are, you know, moral, upstanding people who are trying to do good work. And the rest of the world has this idea sometimes that Chinese scientists play loose. And here's an example, He. But they really don't want what he did to tarnish Chinese science writ large. And I think that's another dynamic that we're watching play out. Right? That people want to defend the fact that you can do good science in China, even if you have some bad examples.
So what did He himself say in his own defense? I mean, he must have directly addressed the criticism. I mean, he must have also known he was about to unleash a total firestorm. And he must have, you know, been ready to say something. What did he say?
Well, the first time that the world at large heard from He directly was in these YouTube videos he released shortly before this conference. And He attempted to portray himself as someone who did this because he was really concerned about people with AIDS in poor countries. But I don't think most people really buy that line because, you know, honestly, IVF is not how you're going to treat rare communicable diseases, maybe inherited diseases. But that aside, you know, when He spoke at the gene editing conference in Hong Kong a few days after releasing these videos, he presented his work and scientists asked him some questions. For example, they asked him about the ethical consent procedure. And Ho said that he had been the one who got the consent from the parents. In fact, you're supposed to have someone who's specially trained, who is not the director of the lab, to get ethical consent. And so he answered these questions matter of factly, sort of. It wasn't clear if he knew sometimes. Sometimes he knew that he was breaking a norm. In some cases, it wasn't clear if he had registered that this was not the way people expected him to behave. He also said, "I feel proud." So he wasn't repentant at all. And, you know, I think that to him, it was important to be first. He was first, whatever other conversation follows from that. You know, Nature, a very respected scientific publication, just released a list of 10 people who mattered in 2018. They put Hu on the list. Of course, the write-up had a lot of criticism of what he did, but, you know, he's still on those lists. So he hasn't hung his head in shame at all.
You know, I mean, Jeremy pointed out, and I've often noted in talks I've given about the fact that there's just not that much discussion of ethics in China when it comes to, you know, the pursuit of some of these very disruptive cutting edge technologies. You know, there's ordinarily, I guess I'd call it a pretty cavalier attitude. And, you know, for something like artificial intelligence, say, you don't have the leading technologists and even a lot of the leading scientists out there in public talking about, you know, as Elon Musk or Bill Gates have done, or the late Stephen Hawking have done, talking about, you know, summoning the demon, to use Musk's phrase. So I was surprised, like Jeremy was, you know, by the reaction within China to his work. Do you think this is a watershed that's going to lead to a broader conversation about the potential hazards of, you know, this whole devil may care pursuit of technologies like AI, like advanced robotics, like genetic engineering? You know, you mentioned what was the name of the experiment you said where syphilis was done?
The Tuskegee experiments in the United States.
Could that be this is a Tuskegee moment for China?
That's a good question. There's a bunch of things you raise. First, to the question of why there's not a robust discussion in China. As you guys know, censorship is a huge restraint on how people can have open dialogues about things. And it's not only a restriction in terms of, you know, people being able to criticize the government, but people being able to have public conversations to come to some kind of consensus about new technologies. There really isn't the space to do that in China.
I don't think that that's such a topic that gets censored, but I think that more than that, it's just like there's, you know, been this development of technology and better lives in such lockstep that they're not at that point where, you know, it has become worrisome.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to slice this debate. And for me, I think less honestly about the line between the U.S. and China, but maybe the line between scientists and tech entrepreneurs. So ideally, yeah, Scientists have peer review and ethical review boards, and technology companies have trade secrets and product launches in beta, because presumably the stakes are lower if it's a social media app. But things get messier in medicine when it's a life or death technology.
Sure,
you can't release something like that in beta. So I think, as I said, having spoken to a lot of individual scientists in China who are sincerely concerned about bioethics, even if they aren't engaging the public at large, I think that for myself, that maybe the difference isn't so much that individual scientists are more or less moral in different countries, but that China has a porous regulatory structure, and that allows outliers or rogue actors to get further and faster, and to get away with a lot more before they get shut down.
Right.
So maybe that's what needs to change if something is going to change.
That's an interesting take on it. It is. It's that line between the technologists, between the scientists and the kind of tech entrepreneur types, right?
Right. Move fast and break things.
Exactly, yeah.
But I mean, one can't divorce that from society at large either. I mean, China generally teaches you to play, you know, fast and loose, to do stuff first and ask for permission later.
Right.
You know, I'm still struggling to adjust to the United States, where generally the rules are mean rules, like you park in the parking place and you stop at the stop sign, and you don't drive on the shoulder of the highway.
I'm sorry, it's been a tough transition for you, Jeremy.
It's very difficult for me to learn to, you know, obey the rules. So I think, you know, it's a very big problem. But let's go back to the American connection, Christina. What about the involvement of HERS Rice University advisor, Michael Diem? What do we know about how much he knew or didn't know? Because you actually spoke to him, didn't you? So what did he say?
Michael Diem spoke to one of my colleagues at AP before he published our story, and he said he'd been directly involved in HERS gene editing experiment. He said he'd flown to China and been present when the participating couples gave their consent, although Diem does not speak Chinese. And he said that he'd been an architect of this ethics approval process. Now, Diem is a physics professor at Rice University, not somebody who works on clinical trials in the U.S. Wow. And since the story's come out, Diem's lawyers have told other media that Diem was not involved in the way he said he was involved. So, and meanwhile, Rice has launched an investigation into what's happening with Diem. But interestingly, Diem was set to take on a new faculty position at a university in Hong Kong in January. And we contacted the university, and they said that right now they're waiting to see what the results of Rice's own investigation will be and whether or not that goes forward. But it looks like Diem had thought that he was en route to Hong Kong in 2020.
Interesting. I mean, this is just sort of part of a larger thing. I mean, I'm not pointing to Michael Diem in particular, but in my own reporting over many years, my sense is that there were a lot of people in the pharmaceutical industry, in biopharma, who kind of appreciate the fact that you can really play fast and loose in China. There are a lot of, you know, there's a permissive environment.
You see that in architecture too, right?
Yeah,
all the wacky buildings that might be too dangerous to build in Germany or the U.S. have been built.
They kind of see China like a playground, kind of.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, to draw a crude analogy, American companies previously put work, you know, outsourced factory work to China, knowing that there were
labor violations and
so this difference in regulations, you know, it's something that people can try to take advantage of. I think it's really important to say what happened here isn't just something that happened in China and from a distance, you know, we shake our fingers, but that He had sought out the advice of lots of people inside, especially outside China, actually, before he did this. And, you know, as you said, with this experiment and with a lot of other things in the technology space, artificial intelligence, right? I mean, there's ideas, people, and money moving between the U.S. and China. It's things rarely these days happen in only one country, and that's the end of it.
Christina, what about He Jianghui's fate? Did he return to Shenzhen after his talk at the Human Genome Editing Summit in Hong Kong?
He did, Jeremy. And if you know exactly where he is and how he's doing, please let me know. My editors would love to know. There were rumors that he was taken into custody, but that seems not to have been true. But he did go back to Shenzhen, and right now we're all waiting to see if there's teeth in any of these investigations and what his future will be. If you have tips, let me know.
He's not responding to emails. He's not responding.
He responded to one email from the Harvard Crimson.
From the Crimson?
Yeah. But he has not been responding to most mainstream media attempts to reach him.
That's a pity. That's fascinating. One last question. I mean, I can't help but wonder, you know, in the, a rush to condemn He and his work, which I totally understand, there's maybe a danger of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, CRISPR can certainly be abused, obviously, but it's also a pretty promising technology when it comes to addressing, you know, certain genetic afflictions, you know, that really do plague a big portion of mankind. Maybe in hindsight, years from now, we're going to see the real tragedy of He Jianghui as the fact that he ended up setting back research.
That's something that a lot of scientists are discussing and worried about. Certainly a lot of scientists believe that the future will see CRISPR used for reducing the occurrence of severe inherited diseases that we have no other way to treat. Again, Huntington's disease is one example that's mentioned often, and they are worried that a backlash against He might make governments tighten regulations that would make it harder to pursue research toward this end. In the meantime, CRISPR is also used or being tested for use in adults, not for editing the germline, but, you know, basically therapeutic use of CRISPR to enhance the ability of white blood cells to fight cancer and other things. So there are a lot of potential medical uses that some scientists will strongly defend, although, you know, at this stage, everything is in a stage of being tested, but a lot of people don't want to see all those tests shut down prematurely.
I totally understand that. Christina, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us. Let's go on to recommendations. Before we do that, I do want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. And if you enjoy the Seneca podcast, all the other shows in our network, like the fantastic Tech Buzz and the Sicing Seneca Business Brief, and the wide-ranging content on SupChina, the best thing you can do is sign up for SupChina Access. Your support makes it possible for us to keep bringing you reporting, conversations, videos, all of it. Now, let's move on to recommendations. And Jeremy, as is our tradition, you may begin.
Okay, I've started moving house, and I have boxes that haven't been opened since I left Beijing. And so I'm going through old books, and I started reading The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins, which is sort of related to today's topic. And it was a little before he became a sort of militant atheist, and it's focused on the science of evolution as seen kind of through the lens of genes, where, you know, he looks at the way genes are passed down, and animals and organisms are just kind of the vessel that lets the genes reproduce and pass themselves down. Anyway, it's a really good, accessible book about evolution and genetics.
It's also old. It's from the 80s or something, right?
Yeah, it's very old. I think I read it in high school, so that must have been in like the 1930s or something.
Great. Richard Dawkins, pre-militancy. No, I think he was already kind of militant. I mean, so it was before, in other words, it was before you really took a shine to him, right?
No, I mean, being militant is one thing, being a one-trick pony and only having one note to sing is another, right?
Right. Christina, what do you have for us?
Well, in a similar vein, Carl Zimmer's book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, which is a you know, basically a continuation of the discussion that we've had today. It's about inheritance and what aspects are encoded in our DNA and what aren't. But I feel like since Jeremy mentioned a similar book, I should offer another recommendation if I can.
Sure.
So absolutely. I wanted to recommend my AP colleagues in Beijing's recent work, tracing products made in the forced labor camps in Xinjiang to sportswear companies importing in the United States, right?
It's really, Statesville.
Yeah, making a connection between what's happening in Xinjiang and you know, what American consumers have access to. So stories moving rapidly, but they've been doing amazing work, and this is only the latest bit of their really strong effort to chronicle what's happening there.
I guess I'm pretty impressed with the way that company has responded. Badger Sportswear, and they really, I guess, you know, it's one of the things that it shows is it's really difficult to figure out exactly where the supply, you know, the whole supply chain, right?
Yeah. I mean, I should say I didn't have a role in reporting that story, but it seems like they were as surprised as anyone else that their name was on that list. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad that they've responded with alacrity to that. Yeah, great set of stories. And maybe in the same vein, Emily Fung's piece from the Financial Times.
Sure, and the New York Times too, right.
Break that. My recommendation is for a book by Jeff Gwynn called The Road to Jonestown. In November, we observed the 40th, it was the 40th, yeah, I guess it was 40 years ago, that the Jonestown massacre had happened in Guyana. And I had really not known too much about Jim Jones and the People's Temple. I heard a couple of radio interviews with the author, and I decided to buy this book, and it's truly fascinating. It's told quite dispassionately because Jim Jones is a sort of remarkable figure. I mean, I think that he suffered very deeply from mental illness, but you know, he was immensely charismatic, and I think in a way that reminds me of, you know, of a lot of radical organizations, from ISIS to the Muslim Brotherhood. They provided social services in a community. They were really quite sort of conscientious in some ways and laudable in a lot of ways, and also just deeply f***ed up in other ways. It's great. It's a really readable and horrifically tragic story about what happened, about how, it's fascinating. I highly recommend it. The Road to Jonestown by Jeff Gwynn. Thanks, Christina. That was terrific. Thank you so much for taking the time to come talk to us about this very important issue.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks, guys.
Jeremy, man, it was great to talk to you again.
Thanks, Christina. Thanks, Kaiser.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn and edited by Jason McRonald and me. Special thanks this week to Jim Millward, who was kind enough to let us convert his dining room into a makeshift studio. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out the other podcasts in our network, the Seishin Seneca Business Brief, the Pandaily Tech Buzz China, New Voices, China Econ Talk, and Ta for Ta. More great shows coming soon. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.